You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 19th of March. And on the show today, as Dubai's Roads and Transport Authority speeds up its response to accidents, we heard how they're planning to do it. That was with Mohammed Al Ali, one of their directors. Meanwhile, as the Dubai World Cup is fast approaching, it is the biggest racing event in the UAE's calendar with a prize purse of over $30 million. We found out what to expect from the event with Samir Khan from the Dubai Racing Club. And a clinic has come up with a possible treatment for long COVID. Dr. Zima Wang told us how his hyperbaric oxygen therapy works in practice. And we also took a look at a top tech trend, because the next time you go for a job interview, it is entirely possible that you could be interviewed by a robot. That's as recruitment agencies are rolling out new software that is powered, of course, by AI. Local recruiter Zaid Al-Hayali from Mark Ellis explained how they've been using the tech, and Professor John Shields from the University of Sydney's Business School talked us through the pros and cons. Meanwhile, there is a crime wave sweeping across Europe, where luxury watches are being stolen from people's wrists. Expert Paul Thorpe talked us through the Rolex Ripper trend. Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. We're about to have a totally fascinating conversation, so hold on to your hats. It's really intriguing, because I want you to imagine for a moment you were invited to interview for a job that you really wanted. You know, how would you feel? A bit nervous, a bit excited. How would you feel if you were told that that interview is going to be done by an AI avatar? Well, turns out that you better get used to the idea.
Welcome to Ivy, the Middle East's first virtual AI-powered interview platform.
Hello, my name is Ali, and I'm a recruiter for Mark Ellis. How are you doing today? Can you please introduce yourself and tell me a little about your experience in recruitment?
It's like having a recruitment specialist right at your fingertips, ready to make your life easier. Ivy is rewriting the rules of recruitment, and you're in control.
Yes, well, that, as you heard, is Ivy, which is spelt A-I-V-I. Very clever. And it's already being used as part of a pilot project by the Dubai-based recruitment firm Mark Ellis. But why? What are the benefits? How are people reacting to this type of robot recruitment? And how do you feel about it? Please do get in touch. Would you like to be interviewed by a robot recruiter? 4001 is the text, or you can WhatsApp me on 04871 5500. To whet your appetite, we've got two fantastic experts joining us on the show today. First up, we've got Zaid Al-Hayali, who is the director at Mark Ellis. He's actually joined me in the studio. Zaid, lovely to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
And also we've got on Teams John Shields, who is a professor of human resource management and organizational studies at the University of Sydney Business School. Professor Shields, thanks for joining us on the line. How are you?
It's my pleasure. Hello from Sydney.
Hello, indeed. Right, Zaid, I'm going to come to you first because you're our local expert. Can you tell me a little bit about Ivy, because you are already implementing it as a policy?
Yep.
Is he or she a good colleague?
I like the way you put it across, a good colleague. Yes, he is indeed, and she is indeed also. We're trying to teach her the job in the right way. And we're also trying to depend on them, on her or him, to actually teach us on how best we can do the recruitment process in a better way. When Ivy is actually driven by our business, and it was created by Mark Ellis to enhance the service that we give to our clients. Now, we do our business based on stats, and some of our clients have given us some shocking stats based on how much time it takes them to actually fill vacancies. And when we dug deeper into the reasons as why, we found out that quality is actually a big problem in this part of the world. I've mentioned this before previously in our last interview. So Ivy was born to actually solve a problem which exists in the market, and that is actually the speed of recruiting people for specifically technical jobs at the moment, but it can actually go further. But the system needs to be a lot more clever to be able to be more emotionally intelligent, I would say. At this moment in time, it can gather information. It will ask questions. It will actually allow the candidate to respond in a normal way, as if it's a normal interview. It will actually gather the information. It can go beyond the ability to technically assess the individual, but also emotionally assess the individual by looking at their eyes and so on. So we're looking at the emotional part of things, because obviously the interview is not just about the technical part. It has to be the emotional side and your ability to communicate in the right way. So
But that's unexpected, because I always just thought you'd be using it to gather information, you know, for those preliminary interviews. I didn't realize you would actually be using it to read emotions.
You can indeed. So if you look at the video that I shared with you, the video shows you that you can actually wear an Oculus. The Oculus allows you, from a technology perspective, you can actually read your eye contacts. Now, what we found also, some candidates are quite cheeky. So when they do the interview, sadly, they then do, try to bend the truth a little bit or not give you the accurate information and so on. So the system, it should eventually be clever enough to pick up this information by looking at your eye positioning, for example. So IV is driven towards getting these results as accurate as possible, which will hopefully, from a business perspective, reduce the amount of time to hire an individual.
I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I've got so many more questions, but I want to bring Professor John Shields in now, because Professor Shields, you'll have an overview. This seems extraordinary to me, but is this type of approach actually becoming a little bit more popular worldwide?
Absolutely. It's becoming widespread. It's an irresistible force for change. And Zayd has done a brilliant job of explaining the logic of the technology and also the current capabilities of the technology, particularly for recruitment and selection. It's still a work in progress, though. As Zayd was saying, we're still some way short of being able to algorithmically program a machine to be able to accurately and thoroughly read a person's nonverbal cues to identify their emotional state and their truthfulness, but that's not all that far off. So definitely a major force for change underway in the HR space, not just in recruitment selection, by the way, but also in areas of high information load and cognitive load and decision-making risk, like performance management and, to a degree, reward management. Even in my own area of tertiary education, universities are experimenting with similar processes to those they'd characterised for the business world. We're experimenting with online preliminary interviewing of prospective students in their candidature to identify their intellectual agility, their English language vocabulary expertise, the way that they configure statements, and also, as Ed was saying, seeking to get a reading of their nonverbal cues, all of which gets fed into a decision-making process.
Okay, can I be completely honest? I think it's awful. I might as well come out and say it. I think it just sounds awful. I think it sounds like we're depersonalizing the process of recruitment or bringing people, you know, choosing candidates for university. I think, if anything, interviewing is the one sort of area, one field where it should involve the human touch. You do need people to talk to people. And I have to say, I don't know whether I'd want to work for a company that didn't take the time to interview me personally. Now, Professor Shields, I'm sure you've done research in this. Is my response typical?
Well, your response is completely natural, and it's not inconsistent with what we are both saying. We're both saying that in terms of at the least initial filtering of job candidates or degree candidates, AI can be enormously helpful in terms of filtering huge volumes of information on individuals. But I would say philosophically that we should still, and probably will always, be wanting to use human contact and face-to-face interviewing, or at least virtual real interviewing of shortlisted candidates for final selection processes. I say that because there is now a very strong body of evidence that suggests that the way that a candidate is selected is an important part of shaping up their psychological expectations about the prospective employer and whether or not they want to go and work with that employer. It's called a psychological contract, and robots, to the very best of my understanding, cannot be involved in the final stage of constituting psychological contracts or if you like, deal expectations between the prospective employee and the employer. That has to be done with a human touch. But in the initial stage of recruitment and recruitment filtering, I think AI is an immensely powerful tool of a positive sort, both in cost terms and also in terms of at least preliminary accuracy in developing shortlists.
Now I'd ripped the Band-Aid off and revealed my true colours when it comes to how I feel about being interviewed by robots. I'm going to ask you the same question. We're just going to go to a very quick break. So I'm going to leave everyone, you know, waiting, because I'd love to know how UAE candidates have felt about, you know, the AI process that you guys have already introduced here in the country, you guys at Mark Ellis. But we're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes. I am going to give Zaid a chance to speak. Sure. But so far, as you can hear, we're mid-conversation with Professor John Shields. He's from the University of Sydney Business School. Also, Zaid Al-Hilali, who is a director at Mark Ellis. We will be getting their response in the next few minutes, continuing our conversation, but obviously I'd love to hear from you. Which side of the fence do you sit on? Do you agree with me that it's a terrible idea, or is Professor John Shields bringing you round to the idea? Would you be happy to be interviewed by a robot?
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to the show. We are talking about whether or not you would be happy to be interviewed for your next job by a robot, basically by a chatbot. It's already happening right here in the UAE.
Ivy understands your job description and, with the power of AI, creates the perfect interview questions on the spot.
What specific recruitment strategies and sourcing techniques have you found most effective in your previous experience as a recruitment consultant in the technology domain?
When it comes to recruitment, I think the most important strategy is networking.
That's great to hear. As a recruitment consultant, you will work closely with clients to help them find top talent.
That is Ivy. That's a virtual recruiter being piloted right here in the UAE by Mark Ellis. I have two experts on the line and we are discussing this as an option. I've got Zaid Al-Hilali, who is director of Mark Ellis, and Professor John Shields from the University of Sydney Business School. Now, Zaid, before we went to the break, I ripped off the Band-Aid, ripped off the plaster, and admitted that I think this is a terrible idea. David's got in touch. He says that I wouldn't like it personally, but I would like it if some public sectors used it for things like the police or social welfare and similar public services. Another message has just come in from this person who says, Reem says, as a recruitment expert, or Rose, this is, I believe that using robots is a brilliant idea. It does the initial screening. It'll save us a lot of time in assessing if the candidate has basic qualifications that allow him to move to the second stage of the interviews, where we can then invest our time. So people disagreeing with me, actually, Zaid. What about you? How have UAE candidates been reacting to this?
It's too early to judge at the moment, in all honesty, because it's very early days in terms of how exposed the system is to the public. But there are reasons why we're introducing AI in the first place into the recruitment world. One of the reasons why we did it is actually, you know, candidates complain about not getting feedback. Now, this system can actually solve this immediately because the feedback is immediate. It's right there and then. So no one can actually say, I've sent my CV to this client and they have not responded, or I've sent my CV to this recruitment agency and they have not responded. And this is a common theme.
It's a big thing, especially here in the UAE.
With the AI, see, you've mentioned a lot of things here when it comes to using AI within the recruitment world. It should not replace the entire process. It should actually become an aid or a helping hand to the recruiter or to the hiring manager to actually filter out the candidates they want to interview. At the same time, give the feedback to the candidates that they can't be considered for the specific job, and it will speed up the entire process. So it's actually a positive addition to the entire process.
I can see where you're getting at there.
So from a business perspective, when we're talking about business, we say speed, you know, is very important because time is money, and AI can actually solve this problem for you, but it will not replace a human touch. So this is part of the process, but not the entire process.
Okay, so the persuasion starts here. We're bringing me round to think that maybe it's a slightly better idea. Professor Shields, are there not concerns that this system could be, I don't know, biased? Or could it have inbuilt sort of, I don't know, anti-female biases of some sort? What do you think?
Yes, obviously. Just like human interviewers have frequently done in the past is... act on
fair.
Implicit bias.
Yeah.
So, you know, the human animal is itself fallible to bias and error in judgments made. And I'm not saying that robots aren't as well. They are, because robots are basically driven by algorithmic programming, and that programming is still done by human beings. And so there are risks. There's risk with any technological change. Economic history is suffused with evidence of the good and the bad of all technological change. It's partly a matter of how the technology is applied rather than the nature of the technology itself. So, you know, artificial intelligence can be used for good or evil. My position is one of agnosticism. I'm not a dystopian. I'm not a utopian about these changes. The changes are coming. We have to work out together how we can use these new technologies for good rather than evil. And I think that's possible to do.
So, Zaid, bringing it back to the UAE, how often are you using this software already? How much is it being brought into play?
So we have trialed it internally. We created Ali, who is an internal recruiter for us, and we are actually educating him on how best to ask questions in terms of the type of questions for a specific skill. Because you can imagine the world of recruitment is so big, so many different job skills and so on. So no matter how AI is smart, you still have to teach it certain ways to get the best answers from it. So right now we're doing a trial on a specific role, which is a recruitment consultant, to see how this person or this AI person will interview this individual versus a human being. And we will get the results and we'll match it. If the match is very close, then we're going in the right way.
Then here it starts.
Yes.
You heard it here first.
Exactly. But in terms of the actual live version of it, is going to come very soon. And we've already spoken to a few of our clients and they're very, very keen, especially those who are actually mass hiring. Because again, time is money for them and they want to make sure they can build their team really, really quickly. And this tool will actually save them a lot of time. So it's just a no-brainer for them. They're waiting for it.
Right. As soon as you have a client, we need to get them in on the radio. I think that's absolutely fascinating. This whole conversation has been very intriguing. As usual, I feel like my view has sort of gently shifted as we've had the conversation. Has yours? How would you feel about being interviewed by a robot? Huge thanks to my guests who came into the studio today. You just heard the voice of Zaid Al-Hayali, who's a director at Mark Ellis. Also, Professor John Shields, who works at the Human Resource Management and Organizational Studies at the University of Sydney Business School. Thank you to both my guests. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. And I have to say, I'm loving everyone's messages this morning. Lots of people sort of coming round to the idea of being interviewed by a robot, a bit like me. I initially thought it was just the most dreadful idea. And I was sort of slightly furious about it. You know how when there's something new, there's the Luddite in you. The Luddite is always angry. Have you noticed? They're always like, there's always a fury. There's a deep-rooted fury that we're all going to be taken over by robots. And I was like, enough is enough. I'm going to be interviewed by a person. Anyway, lots of people getting in touch. Karen says, keep typing how I don't like this idea. But the more I listen to the experts, it's really interesting. The initial sifting of candidates, yes, AI would be great in that context. But any face-to-face interview, I'd want to do that old school. Yes, the person has the skills, but are they going to fit in? You have to be able to find a good fit for your workforce. Karen, thank you for that message. Rose, thank you for yours. And David, thank you for yours as well. Hello there, welcome back to the programme. Lovely to have you with us here on The Agenda. And we're going to look at, I suppose, ultimately it's the problem of the traffic on the roads, that what it sort of all distills down to, because the Roads and Transport Authority have teamed up with Dubai Police to try to reduce the amount of jams on the road. But their focus this time is on accidents. And they say that these problems should be cleared from the roads of Dubai within 15 minutes from now on. That is thanks to a new traffic incident management unit. Well, they've had the unit for a while, but they've now expanded it. Now, of course, we're all dealing with the repercussions of more roads, more cars on the road at the moment. More jams seem to equal more frayed tempers. And I have definitely sort of anecdotally seen more sort of shunts on the road just recently. And that was pre-Ramadan. It seemed to be every single day I was driving around, I'd see some sort of accident of some sort. And of course, more crashes equals more delays on the roads because, you know, people have to move around them. And we're not very good at that. We're not very good at letting people in. And that slows things down. And then the other thing is that, of course, everyone wants to look and see what happens. So you often get delays on the other side of the road, and then that can cause accidents. So there's a real sort of knock-on effect. But now, apparently, on many roads of Dubai, rapid response vehicles should arrive within 10 minutes. And they have a remit or to clear the problem within 15 minutes. Now, I wanted to find out more about this. So earlier I spoke to Mohammed Al Ali. He is from the Traffic and Roads Agency at Dubai's Roads and Transport Authority. And he told me more about how the traffic management program actually works.
Based on a benchmark against best international practices in countries including USA, UK, Netherlands and Sweden, the traffic incident management projects jointly run with Dubai Police offer exceptional services to motorists. That including addressing vehicle breakdown, swift management of accident scenes, and restoring normal traffic flow. The scope of the project also covers implementing temporary traffic diversion in the surrounding areas, aiding motorists, and providing traffic management supporting during the events.
And I understand that you're going to be expanding the program onto other roads, into other areas. So where should we expect to find it now?
Yeah. The expansion increased the total coverage of the project to 13 corridors and streets that include Sheikh Zayed Road, Al Khail Road, Dubai Al Ain Road, Al Yalai Street, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Road, Rabat Street, Airport Street, Emirates Road, Jabal Ali Al Hibab Road, Sheikh Zayed bin Hamdan and Hayat Street, Al Wasl and Jumeirah Street. And by the end of this year, inshallah, we will add four more corridors, which include Ras Al Khor Street, Om Saqim Street, Expo Road, Hissa Street. So this will bring the total to 17 corridors, street and roads, expanding over 951 kilometers in both directions.
So how is this management program controlled? Is it through cameras and artificial intelligence, or is it good old traditional officers keeping an eye on the roads and responding in their cars at speed?
Well, the traffic incident are provided from Dubai ITS Center Systems and Dubai Police System, which are AI-driven systems that send automatic notification to the operation team and control centers that coordinate directly with the field team, which include the patrol vehicles, recovery vehicles, and other emergency vehicles.
So thanks to the program, how fast do you actually, or how fast should we expect to see an officer on the scene after an accident?
Well, a specific location has been designated for the deployment of rapid response vehicle on major highways and critical roads to ensure their quick arrival at accident scenes, aiming for a response time of 10 minutes and a clearance time of 15 minutes. The service achieved response rate, thanks that about 6 minutes and average retail clearance time of 8 minutes. The service contributed in enhancing traffic safety in the road covered by the project in 2023 as compared to 2022, as injuries and fatalities incidents dropped by 6.5%, with fatalities decreasing by 5% across the Emirate. The project stands as a key contributor to enhancement of integrated roads and transport network, which result in improvement of average travel time to 10.2 minutes as per the TomTom index.
That's really interesting because it gives us a sense there of the impact of accidents, because often when you have an accident on the road, it leads to more accidents because people aren't concentrating or they're not expecting it. And then, of course, you know, it also leads to incredible delays. So it's great to hear that work is being done to reduce those delays. Do you see a time when you expect, you know, the entire city of Dubai to be covered by this program?
Yeah, as we mentioned earlier, by the end of the year 2024, additional 4 main corridors will be covered, which will expand the coverage to 17 main corridors in Dubai road network. So we can say mainly all strategic corridors will be covered, inshallah.
Mohammed Al Ali there. He is from the Traffic and Roads Agency. He's a director there, an IT director, in fact, from the Dubai Roads and Transport Authority, talking me through that traffic incident management unit, which is being expanded across the rest of Dubai. Very interesting stuff indeed.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to The Agenda, just after 10:22. Georgia here and with you till 1 now. It is known as the greatest race in the UAE's calendar. It is one of the biggest social and sporting events in Dubai.
And they're into the stretch of the Dubai World Cup. And from the back of the pack, here comes Ushba Tesoro with a rush on the far outside. Algiers to catch. Ushba Tesoro gains in, goes by. Ushba Tesoro hits the front. Ushba Tesoro wins the Dubai World Cup.
Yeah, that is the moment that Japan's Ushba Tesoro made a late rally, a very exciting late rally, to claim first place in last year's Dubai World Cup. You get a little bit of a sense of the excitement and the atmosphere there. And we are talking about that race because, of course, it is about to return. It's hard to believe that we've come round to that time of the year already. But this year's event is due to take place on the 30th of March. It really is an amazing opportunity to watch some of the best horses from around the world, the best jockeys, and they're all competing for this massive prize pot of $30 million. It's actually $30.5 million, and it's across 9 races. Joining us now to talk through what to expect is Samir Khan from the Dubai Racing Club, who has very kindly joined us in the studio. Samir, lovely to have you here. Tell me, bigger and better every year, I'm sure. How do you improve this event every single year?
Hi, Georgia. Lovely to have. Thanks for having me here. And I'm going to talk something. The clip that you just played at the start of this interview really got me goosebumps. And
yes,
actually just want to tell you that Ushba Tesoro is running again and competing for the Dubai World Cup in 2024.
He's coming back.
Yes,
to fight
back.
What's the expression when they want to sort of hold the title? That's
yes,
what it is.
Yes.
Well, so hugely excited. So and that's not the only impressive horse coming our way, is it?
No, we've got some other horses. We've got a Kazakhstan-based horse who got trained locally and has won, and has actually won hearts of so many race goers here in Dubai, called Kabir Khan. So that's a horse to look out for as well.
And is Godolphin, because of course the local
yes,
horse team here.
Yes.
You'll tell I'm choosing my words carefully. I know nothing about horse racing, so I'm so pleased you're here. So yeah, the local team is Godolphin. And
yes,
do they have any horses running in that final all-important race?
Yes, they do have horses running in the final race, and they've got horses running across all the other races as well. And we're going to be sharing all these, you know, the post-position draw, which is going to take place on the 27th of March. We'll decide on the gates that the horses are going to start from. So you can watch out for those details. Apart from that, our $30.5 million US prize money giveaway.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
It's Is it the leading prize fund? Or there are a couple of countries that have another one, isn't there? A higher one.
Yes, they do. So our the prize money that we're giving away for the Dubai World Cup itself is like $12 million. But we have a competition now with Saudi Cup because they have hiked up their prize. But our race is still called the most spectacular race.
Well, it's the most popular race in the Middle East. There aren't very many other places where you get the level of turnout that you get here in the UAE. This is the second year that the race will be taking place during Ramadan. Should we still expect the same amount of pageantry and fun that we have got to know, you know, for the Dubai World Cup?
Yes, we're still expecting our guests because we have hospitality packages that start from 2 p.m. so people can still have their regular food and beverages. And apart from that, we've got a special iftar package, which is just going out for 595 dirhams. All-inclusive of food and soft beverages. And the kids' prize is $295. So people can still come in when they're fasting, enjoy their iftar and watch the races, watch the excitement while they're there with their family and friends. And apart from that, we've got some premium restaurants that are offering tickets from AED2550, which is again inclusive of food and standard house beverages. And our top a package, which is the royal enclosure for 10,000 dirhams, which is going to give you a really VIP experience, which includes a chauffeur driven car. So we're going to come and pick you up from your house and then drop you back home.
And in that circumstance, you get right up close to the racehorses,
exactly.
Don't you?
Exactly. Yes, you do. You get the opportunity of going down to the parade ring, watching the horses parade, watch the winning horse coming into the enclosure. So it's going to be a really up close experience with the horses as well.
So we've mentioned two of the big things that race day is all about. Number one, the racing, of course.
Yes.
Number two, the F&B, which people get very excited about. But what else is going on around the edges of this? Because I know that there's several other things to look forward to on race day.
Yes. So apart from this, we've got some great entertainment lined up. We've got some aerobatics that's going to happen during the day. We've got our great drone show and we've got our fireworks, obviously, after the ninth race. So, and again, you know, we're trying to beat some Guinness World Records this year. So beat three Guinness World Records this year. And obviously, the show is going to be amazing. And this is something that people need to watch out for just after the final race. So we are expecting over 30,000 guests to come and attend. And apart from that, we are also going to have the Style Stakes, which is the fashion element of the Dubai World Cup, the most famous fashion show. We've got five different categories that people could compete for, which is Best Dressed Lady, Best Dressed Man, Best Dressed Couple, Best Traditional Outfit and Hat. And the Style Stakes is sponsored by Amar, and they're giving away fabulous prizes along with Emirates and Fasik Dukhoon and Sisters Lounge, 1847 Grooming for Men. So they've got great prizes.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to get dressed up. That's always part of the day.
Yes.
I know everyone's a bit like, you know, where am I going to get a hat?
Yes.
That's the huge thing. It's all everyone talks about hats. Now, you know, if you've never been to the races before, mm-hmm. and like I said, I only went for the first time. It was literally my first ever horse race. You know, you start at the top, basically. Yeah. If you've never been to the races before, how does the day unfold? You know, what time does it start? You know, should you take snacks? You know, how does it work? You know, do you start the day off in your fancy outfit and wear it for the whole day? How does it sort of work?
Yeah, so our gates open at 1 p.m. in the afternoons and the hospitality is open from 2 p.m. onwards. We've got so people who purchase the Apron Views tickets, which is at AED 295, which is admission. It gives you access to the Apron Views along with the access to the F&B area. So we've got various food and beverage outlets available that you can buy your food from. And we actually don't encourage people to get their own food. Because
don't bring snacks because you can buy amazing. There's lots of food trucks and things out there.
We've got McGettigans who will be operating in the Apron Views. So then you can come and get your drinks from there. And obviously, we're going to have some entertainment lined up from McGettigans as well within the Apron Views area. And the
Apron Views, that's also right by the racetrack, isn't it?
So you can
sort of lean quite close and see the horses galloping
Absolutely,
past.
Absolutely, yes. So you can just lean by the fence and you can actually watch the horses run past the final stretch.
And there's races all day, aren't there? From 2 p.m. onwards, they're sort of spaced out throughout the afternoon.
Yeah, so the gates open at 1. The race, the first race is going to start at 3:30. And then we've got races between every 35 to 45 minutes of gap. And then the final race is at 8:35, which is the Dubai World Cup. And we've got the trophy presentation at 9, and our opening, the closing ceremony would be around roughly between 9:15 to 9:20.
So it's a full afternoon out. Final question then, how can you get those tickets, the sort of non-hospitality cheapest tickets?
Yes, so general admission is just AED20, and you can buy these tickets online from our website, which is DubaiRacingClub.com.
Amazing. It's, it is, I have to say, it's one of those things. It's the same with the Dubai Duty Free Tennis. The fact that these extraordinary events are held right here in the Middle East, in Dubai, it's a huge opportunity to go and see things that previously, you know, it would be certainly beyond my budget to go to other events of this type. So it's very exciting, well worth taking advantage. And it is beautiful weather, 30th of March, the very best weathers. Samia, always lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for coming to chat to us on the agenda. You look very calm for someone who's about to be involved in one of the biggest events of the year.
Yes, I have to go back to the chaotic office environment now.
I'll send you back to carry on with your job at the Dubai Racing Club. But Samia Khan, thank you so much.
You're most
time.
Welcome, Georgia.
It's
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Welcome back to The Agenda. Now, regular listeners will recall that we covered long COVID on the programme on Friday as the world marked Long COVID Awareness Day. The condition is still affecting millions of people, 65 million to be exact, around the world. That's according to recent figures. Here in the UAE, thousands are still suffering from the disorder. That is according to Dr. Sweta Adashia, who we spoke to last week and who runs the long COVID program at Gargash Hospital.
Issues in focus and concentration are still the ongoing symptoms that we see in the clinic, and it is the after effects of that post-COVID infection which is going on. So I would say somewhere 3% is a good rough figure where people are still struggling and people cannot be completely, you know, functional or completely back to life unless they do all the changes in their lifestyle, which we have been propagating for these patients as well.
Now, the good news is that one medical center in Dubai is suggesting that hyperbaric oxygen therapy could be an option. DP World's Aviv clinics have revealed their long-term results from their latest study on patients who actually underwent the therapy for the last year. Joining me now to explain more is Dr. Zamir Wang, who is the medical director at that clinic, joining me on the line. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning, sir. Can you tell me, I mean, first of all, what is a hyperbaric oxygen therapy? When it's at home, you could tell I can't even find the noun. What happens when you have this treatment?
Okay, so good morning, and thank you for having me on the show. It's a big privilege for me. So hyperbaric oxygen essentially is breathing pure oxygen in a pressure that is above the ambient pressure that we're usually on. You can think about it as sitting in an airplane that doesn't go anywhere, and when the airplane takes off, you have this change of the pressure in your ears. So this is sort of what it feels like. And then when there's emergency oxygen mask that would come on if something happens. So here without an emergency, you get the oxygen mask and you breathe oxygen in a higher pressure than the environment. This essentially is hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
And how does it help to treat long COVID? How does this pressurized oxygen make a difference?
So we need to speak or say a few words about long COVID in order to understand that. So long COVID is a substantial issue. We know that up to 30% of people who had COVID and were not hospitalized, that is relatively mildly, would be suffering for it. Over 70% of people who are hospitalized for COVID will have long effects, and even 12% of people who are vaccinated. Long COVID we call something or symptoms that persist over 3 months after that we had the COVID infection. And usually it has cognitive and physical symptoms. So cognitive would be some people describe a brain fog. Other people describe anxiety and sort of psychiatric symptoms in a way, maybe depression. And other people even have physical symptoms. They cannot go up a flight of stairs that they could easily have done before. So this is just a general about the symptoms.
And so,
okay, so far?
Yeah, I've got you so far. And have they figured out what's causing the symptoms? And have you therefore figured out how this treatment helps deal with those symptoms?
So the COVID virus has a very interesting mechanism of action. If you're looking at the brain, because this is our main focus, there's three ways that the COVID virus actually accesses our brain. One is that it causes inflammation, including inflammation inside our central nervous system. And this is one of the things that causes the symptoms. Another thing is it causes hypercoagulation, which means tiny strokes that may happen in our small blood vessels in the brain. So it's not like a big stroke that part of our body will stop functioning, but these are tiny strokes that will stop small processes happening in the brain. And this will cause the symptoms. And I think the least known and the most interesting mechanism is through our nose, the virus actually has direct access to the brain and to the frontal lobe. And we can actually see residues of this virus inside our brain. So all these three mechanisms on different levels will cause these changes in our central nervous system that I described before.
And so you've now been treating 31 patients over a period of a year. They've had up to 40 daily sessions in the hyperbaric chamber. What positive results have you seen from this treatment?
So we've treated much more than 31 patients. The study was with two groups of around 30 patients. One was taking the oxygen treatment, while the other one was getting a sham protocol, where we're essentially... they thought they were getting the same treatment without actually receiving the hyperbaric oxygen. This is a study that was published in 22 and actually showed significant improvement in cognitive and physical function. Predominantly, the cognitive aspects of attention, of executive function, but also things like sleep quality and other things.
So what's the theory? What is the oxygen therapy actually doing? Is it getting rid of the tiny blood clots? Is that the theory?
So the interesting thing about hyperbaric oxygen is it actually caters to all these three mechanisms that I was describing. So regarding the tiny blood clots, yes, the oxygen, we know, brings up new capillaries. We call it angiogenesis. So small new blood vessels form in the brain and other parts of the body. And this is bringing blood and oxygen to the areas that were affected. Hyperbaric oxygen has a very, very strong anti-inflammatory effect. And we know that from treating other inflammations. So this reduces inflammation in the brain. And hyperbaric oxygen helps regenerate tissue. Also in the brain, we know that from healing wounds in the legs and the feet. We know that from other mechanisms that we use hyperbarics for, but also in the brain. We can improve the tissue function and it creates stem cell proliferation. So all these things are actually catered for with the hyperbaric protocol.
Absolutely fascinating. I imagine it's not something you can get on the insurance yet.
Unfortunately not. Like every new medical modality, it takes time for the insurances to catch up. But we have treated many cases here in Dubai and our success rates are very, very high.
Really interesting to hear there about that unusual and a new sort of form of treatment for long COVID, which, as we know, is still a huge problem, not just here in the UAE, but certainly even more further afield where there was less of a sort of speedy vaccination program. Dr. Zima Wang there, thank you very much indeed for your time. He's from DP World's Aviv Clinics, where he is their medical director.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Welcome back to The Agenda. Taking a look now at an international news story that, of course, would impact on anyone, traveling to Europe. In particular, if you have a rather fancy watch, because Europe is currently grappling with a wave of crime. London seems to be the epicenter, and the trend is called the Rolex Ripper trend. It's seen the number of stolen watches nearly double in England and Wales between 2015 and 2022 to over 11,000. But in all, more than $1.3 billion worth of watches have been reported stolen or missing in 2022. Watches account for more than 4% of violent robberies in Barcelona in Spain. So that's just a few of the stats that I can sort of throw out to you. But there's certainly a serious problem that is being caused by basically criminals coming together to target these watch wearers. We wanted to find out a little bit more about it. And I'm delighted to say that joining me on the line now is Paul Thorpe. He is a retired watch dealer. He's an authority on watch crime. And he runs a popular YouTube channel dedicated to all things luxury watches. He joins me now on Teams. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us. Tell me a little bit more about this crime. Is it opportunist or is it organised?
Morning, Georgia. Thanks for having me on. I mean, I would say that it's both, to be fair. I think we have a problem right across Europe, but possibly particularly here in the UK with organised criminal gangs. But you do, of course, have your opportunists as well. I'm afraid the BBC did a programme, excuse me, called the Rolex Rippers, that I think a lot of people in the business felt actually glamorized crime. I'm sure it wasn't deliberate, but it highlighted the benefits of stealing watches a lot. And I don't think that helped. You know, I think it showed people that there's maybe a bad career opportunity out there. So, you know, look, you've got both, I'm afraid. But the highly organized criminal gangs right across Europe are very active. That's an undeniable fact. And the stats prove that and back that up.
Why are watches suddenly proving so attractive to thieves? People have been wearing posh watches for years.
Well, of course, yeah, absolutely. But we've had a significant price increase, a price explosion over the last 3 or 4 years, 5 years now, really. And, you know, look, people see them as a simple, ideal opportunity. You know, you've got the risk versus reward factor. The authorities have not really clamped down on watch crime. The perpetrators that have been caught have often got away with pretty light sentences by comparison, and they look at it as a risk versus reward industry. So look, if you can steal someone's watch that's worth £100,000 and then get a suspended sentence if you're caught, that's much better than trying to rob a bank for the same amount of money, and if you're caught you get 10 years in jail. So the criminal justice system needs to catch up.
It sounds like these watches are becoming increasingly valuable. Once they've got them, are they easy to sell on? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I think they often pass around in groups. You know, one person will steal it, their friend will buy it. There are obviously darker areas of the industry where people will have so-called dealers. I would refer to them as criminals, not professional watch dealers, that would maybe accept those watches. Yeah, I think ultimately the way to stop this is quite complex, but we need Rolex to reintroduce their lost and stolen register. That's the first thing. They discontinued that in 2011, therefore taking away the ability to be able to tell if a Rolex watch is stolen in the first place, which is obviously not a good idea.
So that was when there was a serial number or something, I guess, on it, and it was registered to a person.
Well, it's not registered to a person, but what happens is back in the day, if the watch was stolen, you could report it to Rolex. They would put it on their official lost and stolen register. And then before anyone bought a Rolex, they could ring up Rolex and ask them if that watch was on the stolen list. They took that away around about 2011, quite deliberately, in my humble opinion. For reasons of their own, to drive customers into their authorised dealer stores rather than through pre-owned watch dealers. It worked very well for them, if that was their motive. It's been an unfortunate one for watch owners, I'm afraid. It's not the only cause, but it's part of the problem. But we need the reintroduction of the official Rolex lost and stolen register. You know, we do have different organisations, the Watch Register, Digital Watch Vault, that will help and assist, but we don't have access to the official lost and stolen registers of most of the large Swiss watch brands, especially the ones that are targeted by the thieves.
I've got about 30 seconds left with you, Paul. What's the solution in the short term? Is it true that people are being advised just not to wear their smartwatches when they go to some of the capital cities in Europe?
Georgia, I was out in Dubai recently and it was a marked difference. I felt very safe out there. It's a wonderful place to wear your luxury watch. Unfortunately, London and some of the bigger major cities around Europe now are not safe. If you're coming to the UK, look, it's not the Wild West, but my advice would be to leave your luxury watches at home. That would be my advice.
Goodness me. Extraordinary. Paul, thank you so much. Great to have you join us on the line. Thank you for your expertise. Really lovely to speak to you. That's Paul Thorpe. He is a retired watch dealer, an authority on watch crime, and he runs a popular YouTube channel dedicated to all things luxury watches. So give him a Google, Paul Thorpe. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Lovely to have you join us on the line. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.